Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation at americascannabisconversation.com. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
Hello and welcome to this edition of America's Cannabis Conversation Weekend Preview. I'm your host, Dan Perkins. First up on the show is John Cachia, the Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data, which is the authority in cannabis market data analysis. He's going to talk about what's going on in the federal decriminalization, on how momentum may have slowed down, and how the slowdown may affect the ultimate passage of this legislation. Next up is Gary Robertson. He is the co-founder of the band Journey and the co-founder of Guild Extracts and Cal Labs. Guild Extract products, award-winning cannabis concentrates, including THCA Crystalline. And Cal Labs was founded as a medical plant tissue culture company and the forefront of the cannabis cultivation and extraction process. Major Scott Husing, United States Marine Corps Reserve, recently completed a journey of over 3,000 miles from San Francisco to Southeast Florida, stopping along the way to help communities understand the issue of veteran suicide. And last up is Deborah Furholden, PhD from the University of Michigan State, and she is an endowed professor for public health, and she's dean of the Public Health Integration and director of the Flint Center for Health Equity. Welcome back to America's Cannabis Conversation, and this segment, Discover, Engage, and Compete in the Cannabis Landscape, is presented by New Frontier Data, a global leader in cannabis data. Joining us today is the Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data, John Cachia. Welcome, John.
It's a pleasure to be back, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're welcome. We're going to talk with John today about, he was on recently talking about his first impressions of the Schumer bill. And I thought it would be a good idea, since their whole company is about cannabis, that we bring him back on and ask him to tell us, what does he think are the things that we as lay people should be paying attention to see what's happening, to determine the likelihood of any legislation coming out of the Congress this year. So, John, what do you think?
I think it's already quite clear that the bill, as it has been currently presented, is not going to be able to get through the Senate. There's a lot of the issues that have sparked a lot of concern, both amongst lawmakers on the conservative and on the liberal side, as well as within the industry. So a few things that I would suggest watching for. First is just the overall political climate. If the extraordinary kind of debates and contention that's currently happening in the Senate and in Congress more broadly, around issues like infrastructure bill, the kind of federal tax policy, even around kind of COVID-19 and the national response to it. All of that is churning the water and I think souring the water for there to be comity on an issue like cannabis, which, you know, candidly, I don't think there's a lot of Republicans who have a lot of invested political interest to stick their necks out on this issue.
I don't normally do this, but I have to on this particular subject. We heard this week that the president believes he does not have the votes in the Senate to get the infrastructure bill passed. And there have been several bills that, either by filibuster or inability to muster enough votes, the administration's programs seem to be in serious trouble across all fronts. And when we said on the last program that everybody was optimistic when Biden came in about the cannabis getting done, that you're suggesting that the president's program is running, the president's agenda, including cannabis, is running into heavy waters, and the likelihood is that there may not be passage not only of his cannabis reform, but many other risk programs. Am I hearing you that you're agreeing with that?
So, you know, there are some legislative maneuvers, such as reconciliation, which they might be able to use to get some of the key set pieces through. So, for example, I think there's a debate happening right now around using reconciliation, which is a kind of budgetary procedural process to get an infrastructure bill through. But this is part of just the function of having the Senate 50-50 divided between Democrats and Republicans. If there's a 60-vote requirement, it means you've got to be able to poach at least 10 Republicans to support the issue. And given the infighting, or given the contentiousness of the air in Capitol Hill right now, there's not a lot of Republicans who are willing to break party ranks or interested in breaking party ranks to support the administration's major policy initiatives. On cannabis, I actually think it's a little bit different, because even excluding the challenge that there's going to be to secure Republican support for this, I think this bill, as it currently stands, is already drawing some concern within the Democratic Party around some of the provisos here, whether it is around the nature of the proposed FDA's governance of the cannabis industry, or about the idea of federal a 25% federal excise tax on cannabis that in markets like California would mean that you're dramatically increasing the price of legal cannabis and thereby creating a very strong incentive for the perpetuation of the illicit or unregulated market. Due to the structure of the proposed regulations, I think they're going to need to do quite a bit of work to secure full support within the Democratic caucus, let alone the challenge that they're going to have trying to get 10 or more votes from the Republican Party to get this federally approved.
John, I heard late last night that there was a procedural vote on the infrastructure bill. Procedural vote late yesterday. It did not pass. So it couldn't even get through the procedural vote. And there are some people now saying on the Hill that it's basically dead. In addition to that, Biden came out yesterday, and this is, again, it's going to take some of the wind out of the sails of the Democrats. He came out yesterday saying that he thinks that, hey, I'm not in favor of getting rid of the 60-vote requirement because he thinks that it would be chaotic in Congress if we got rid of that, and that it wouldn't be good for the country. So he's somewhat thrown, at least for the moment. He does get his schedule changed around, or it takes things back. But he was very disappointed that even the basic fundamental procedural vote didn't pass on the infrastructure bill at $1 billion, which is down from 2.4, 2.2 trillion that he was looking for to $1 trillion. So there are a lot of things that are going on, and there's more and more division, and we're coming into not too far away of a year to the midterm election, which the sitting party for the White House historically loses votes. Well, they only have to lose one vote to lose the majority in the Senate, and probably 4 to 6 votes to lose the majority in the House. So a lot of stuff going on that could adversely affect lots of legislation and the ability for the Congress, both the Senate and the House, to work together. Do you expect that turmoil to continue, or do you think there'll be a quieting down and a need to want to get something done?
Well, you know, we look at the world through the lens of the cannabis industry and how all of these machinations are implicating our market. And I would say this, we actually think it may not necessarily be a bad thing if for the local, the state and local operators, if the federal proposed legislation didn't pass immediately. I think it would be important to be able to try and get banking reform done. I think that continues to be a major drag on the industry's growth. But some of these other provisions There's actually some utility in terms of being able to support the growth of really vibrant state-based markets if the federal government does not yet intervene in this space. For the people who are currently operating in the space, one of the big concerns has been as soon as the federal government flips the switch, then you have the big box, the major kind of consumer packaged goods companies, alcohol, tobacco, big box retailers, all looking for ways in which to get involved in this market. And
sure,
the longer that that gets delayed, the more opportunity that the current stakeholders in this industry have to establish size, scale, efficiency that makes them much more competitive when the market does finally go federally legal. So,
right.
We've been speaking to some really savvy stakeholders in this space who are essentially tuning out the noise at the federal level because they don't believe that the federal action is going to be happening, at least federal legalization is going to be happening anytime soon. And they're really working very aggressively to build capacity in this state-based model we currently have so that, by the time, whether it is 2 years, 4 years, or 8 years from now, that we finally do see federal legalization, that they'll be in a very strong position to defend their stake in the market as new entrants start to come in post-legalization.
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. You know, the every time that the president gets something defeated, even by the minority of 50 votes in the Senate, the filibuster of 60 it becomes an even more daunting task as we get closer and closer to the midterm elections and we start the campaigning in about 7 months for the midterm election. We're going to see if the agenda changes on the part of the president and the part of the Democrats. And I suspect, as you alluded to just a few months ago, there are two very different factions within the Democratic Party, the more moderate and the far left. And right now, the left seems to have control of the party, but I don't know what they're going to have it for, how much longer they're going to have it. Anyway, we spent a lot of your time, and I appreciate that you're being generous with your time. We've been speaking with John Kajiya, the chief officer for Frontier Data. And thank you for joining us, John. Your insights are always greatly appreciated.
It was my pleasure, Ben.
Thank you. If you miss any of this interview with John, go to W420RadioNetwork.com. Go to the archive section and look for this show. You can also see John on many, many other shows. The smart guy, you should listen to what he has to say. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins with more information on the new Frontier Data software called Equio. Let me ask you this question. Would the success of your business be impacted if you knew the frequency of visits customers spent in competitor stores? Of course it would. The question is, where do you go to get this information? This is just one of the many pieces of information that you can get through the Equio software available at newfrontierdata.com. Remember to click on the Equio button and don't forget to ask for the special offer. I'm Dan Perkins.
Time now for the lowdown on another high time experience. Here's 420 lifestyle correspondent Rich Walkoff.
Well, today a fun show with a musician, a producer, a yacht captain, a sailor, a longtime cannabis connoisseur, founder of Guild Extracts. He's an author. What does a man not do? He's a Renaissance man, Jerry Robertson. Welcome to the W420 Radio Network, brother. How are you?
Hey, very good. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, your tales are legendary going back to the day you were involved with Carlos Santana and Journey and the cannabis connection. So tie us all in, because we all know that cannabis is a creative spark and music and good weed go together great.
Yes, they do.
Well, tell us the origins of how you got together with Journey. Was that first or was Santana first? And
Yeah, the Santana band, I started working for Santana when I was about, 18, 19 years old. And we'd go on the road and set up all the equipment for them. We turned that into a company called Primo Productions. And then we went worldwide with Santana for, about 5-6 years. And then we turned that whole program into the Journey Band.
Wow. So now, was your role what was your role actually?
I was like an entrepreneur. I already made a bunch of money myself, so I had some money to spend on equipment, and I bought a house for all the rock and rollers. We were from Lafayette, you know, so I brought the band over, the Frumious Bandersnatch band from Lafayette, some of the Steve Miller guys, to Forest Knowles out here in Marin County.
Awesome. And that's California. That's Northern California for the uninitiated or out of town. Yeah. So this, when we talking about the late 60s, early 70s?
Early 70s. Yep. 1970.
Well, I remember meeting Carlos Santana and telling him about my experience at the Bay Area Music Awards, the BAMMIES, when I thought his band was transcendent. And he said, it's always great when the music plays the band.
Absolutely.
And I love that.
Yeah. What an amazing guy, amazing musician, just an incredible personality and a friend, you know. So, you know, we have a long history.
Sure. And tell me how the weed world infused some of the creative spark for the musicians that you work with and around.
Right. The first time I smoked pot, it was during the Vietnam, when Vietnam War was just starting to rage, and Quicksilver Messenger Service was the band. And I watched them play and went outside and smoked some pot with a couple of guys, and it changed my life forever. So got me into the music world and got me out of Vietnam. I just wanted to make music, be with the music, play the music, and just enjoy it.
What wonderful. As Quick Messenger Service said, have another hit of Sweet Air, right?
That was yeah, a great they did.
Signature song. So Carlos, as I think I know correctly, is a big fan. And I know the guys at Journey are. So we got to share some inside stories that wouldn't sell out the guys. But what can you share with us?
With the Journey guys?
Yeah, and with Carlos. I mean, how that impacted or influenced his music and in the herb world and the like?
Well, you know, like I said, I was there for the music and the fun and the experience, the travels. the last gig that I really did with them was in Europe in the Montreux Jazz Festival. So, just traveling the world with them and just experiencing all that music. We'd be on the road with Jose Feliciano and Buddy Miles and, all these incredible characters, BB King. And I got to meet all these cats and hang out with them. And, you know, it's just a thrill of a lifetime.
Well, we all know that a lot of these guys like to fire it up maybe after the show. But what about before the show? What was the regimen like, the routine?
Most of the guys were climbing out of bed at, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, getting ready for the gig that night. So, everybody was getting excited and, some of them drank, some of them took acid, some of them smoked a little pot, some of them did some other stuff. And, it was just always, it was just always a different scene, and the music changed every night. I have to tell you, all those songs, when they're being live on stage, they change them up in the middle and they do different stuff, and it was always new every night, it was always an amazing show.
Sure. Now, when I met your son, Brad, who is an awesome dude, and we interviewed him, and it'll be airing on the America's Cannabis Conversation shortly, about the Guild Extracts, the dispensary, actually. It's a company that focuses on concentrates and THC crystalline and molecular isolates. I mean, I thought I was talking with a PhD in chemistry or something, but you've been involved in that and one of the founding members. So talk a little bit about that stuff, which is taking cannabis 2.0 to the next level.
Yeah, certainly. My son has been on the forefront of all this innovation in the cannabis business. We started this company, we've been at it for the better part of 10 years now, developing this. And he just loves being in the lab. You know, he loves coming up with new ideas and isolates and, you know, and all this stuff. And, you know, I don't pretend to even know anything, you know, much about it, really. I listen, I learn, but, you know, it's a whole different level.
Yeah. Now, THCA powder and batter and live sauce and things that, you know, I'm an aficionado like you, and we go back, we're OGs, man. We go back to day. But this is all new to me. So what can you share about what your son has taught you as we go intergenerational in the cannabis world?
Right. Well, you know, he just really got on his phone, really literally, and started doing research. And he found all, you know, the places like the Israelis and the Spaniards were, you know, really innovative in finding, you know, all of these compounds that come out of the cannabis plant. So he started studying and figuring it all out. And, you know, pretty soon he's in the lab doing the same experiments that they were and drawing these incredible compounds out of, you know, out of the oil. So that's, you know, that's really where it started. And he just accelerated. Pretty soon we were making THCA, which is a non-psychotropic ingredient that people can take in large doses for their health. And if they, you know, they can't stand the high part of the cannabis plant, then they get all of that medication and they can, you know, it helps them.
Yeah, the evolution is incredible. And it's really a shame that there is very little federal research, that it has to be entrepreneurs like yourself and your son with Guild Extracts doing a lot of the challenging, you know, new world research, because the federal government doesn't want to either put money or do anything to make it happen.
No, not at all. The pharmaceuticals are, you know, pharmaceutical companies, the big oil production companies, and, you know, cotton, and, you know, there's a tons of industries that are just against the cannabis movement for lots of reasons.
Yeah, it threatens their turf. Well, speaking of turf, when I met your son on your beautiful Empress yacht in Richmond Harbor in Northern California a few weeks ago in your Canna Connect gathering, that is just a blast. He showed me a photo of you, Jerry. You're sitting down. Well, you should tell the tale. This is 1974 in Afghanistan, and you're smoking hash. What is this all about? How did that come to be?
Well, so it was the last show of the Santana tour in Europe was in Montreux. And my girlfriend and I bought a car and started driving around Europe. We ended up down in Greece and then up to Turkey and off to Afghanistan we went. You know, Kabul didn't look very far when we were looking at it in Istanbul on a map. So we drove all the way there and up by the Khyber Pass. And on the way out of the country, we stopped at this, at an oasis, literally. And that's when I met that family. And it was the last day we were really in Afghanistan. So I shaved off a bunch of hash into that nice big hookah pipe. And we smoked it up with with the family. It was just wonderful.
Yeah. Now, they were the ones, as a host, welcoming you with their Afghani hash?
Yeah. Well, I had it. I had it with me, and I had that pipe with me. But, you know, in the desert, you know, you come upon these oases, literally an oasis, with olive trees and it's a fortress. I mean, behind us, you can't see it in the picture, but there's literally a fortress. And behind that fortress is a reservoir of water. And they rule the whole region because they have that water. And that was a family that we just stopped on the side of the road to get under the shade of the trees when they came down to see who was on their property.
I see.
We ended up being really good friends. I had some medicine with me, and then they had some medical issues. I gave them all my, you know, my whole medicine cabinet, and then also all the Afghani money I had in my pocket. And of course they loved me for that. And we were forever friends.
Wow. So what was the experience like in smoking the peace pipe outside of Kabul, Afghanistan? That's wild. Not many people can tell that tale.
It was an amazing experience. They, you know, the Afghanis were the most beautiful people in the world. They really were. They, everywhere we went, their arms were open. They wanted us in their homes. They wanted to cook for us and know who we were. It was just, they're amazing people. It's just a horrible shame what has happened to the beautiful country and the beautiful people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad there was a bond for you, and facilitated by the great, wonderful world of Herb. That is awesome. Hey, I understand you had an interesting Father's Day. A Rock and Roll Hall of Famer hanging out. What's this?
Yeah, that's right. My friend Ross Valerie and his beautiful wife came to my house here in Sausalito. And my son and his beautiful girl and my new grand boy, Cole, and my friend Steven. And we had a beautiful barbecue and enjoyed the day. And then we had a nice jam. At the end of the day, we did like four or five songs. And Ross played bass and I played my guitar and sang. And Steven played the backup and rhythm. And it was a little Cole. We had a little Cole on the conga drum. So.
That's awesome. For those who don't know, Ross Valerie was the original bassist for Journey in a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Now, do I understand correctly that you're writing a book about some of your exploits in the music world?
I am. It should be out. I'm hoping it's out in the fall. Probably by the winter time next year, we'll have this thing out and hopefully published. And on the shelves, well, everybody can read it.
Yeah, what's the focus?
It's the primary title is going to be From Santana to Journey, a trip with bands. That's potentially going to be the title, and okay. It's literally, you know, from my early days with Santana, and you know, producing the Journey band and being on the road with those guys, and lots of cool stories in between, you know, some of the stuff that happened on the road and meeting some of the stars and hanging out with B.B. King and, you know, stuff like that.
And don't forget Lucille, right?
Yeah, I can't forget Lucille.
Hey, you got to give us a little snippet. You got to give us a little sneak peek. Give me a cool Carlos Santana story that will be part of your book so we can, you know, get whet our appetite a little bit.
Okay. Well, there was a little incident in Puerto Rico when the stage was stormed by the crowd, got past the barriers, and they were all climbing underneath the stage and forcing the stage to almost collapse. And we all had to gather all our stuff up and run for the cars and limos that were waiting for us. So that's one story, you know, grabbing Carlos by the, you know, by the back of the shirt and kind of dragging him along with me to jump in the while the crowds were like really literally storming the stage.
Wow.
So that's one little thing.
Yeah. How about a journey tale? Give us a journey.
Okay. Let's see a journey story. Well, I'll tell you what, when we first made that band, when we first had the band together, so that was Neil Sean, Greg Raleigh, Ross, Valerie, and George Tickner. And the first time we recorded, the drummer was late. That was Ainsley Dunbar hadn't shown up yet. And so I was I sat in on the traps and played drums for the tune up for the recording, the first recording we ever did with the Journey band.
Oh my goodness. Look at you jumping in when needed you. Awesome. Hey Jerry.
Yeah, that's right.
It was super.
Give him the hook.
Well, did he supplant you? Did he regain his throne? What happened?
Well, I tuned it all up for him. You know, I had it all tuned for him when Ainsley came in the room and sat down.
Well, good. Jerry Robertson, you're a cool dude. Thanks for sharing some fun stories. Look forward to reading your book. You have a title yet?
Yeah, I think we're going to call it From Santana to Journey, A Trip with the Bands.
Okay, yeah.
Or something like that.
Okay, that works.
If you have any suggestions, let me know.
Well, rock on, man. That's awesome. And continue success on the seas and on land and the Guild Extracts and the yacht, the Empress. Hopefully we can get back on the Canada Connect ship once more.
Yeah, no doubt. You're always invited, Rich. I really appreciate you having me on your show today.
Well, it's a blast. You're a good dude. This is the W420 Radio Network. If you want to hear this again or excerpts, you go to W420RadioNetwork.com/archive. I'm Rich Walkoff. Thank you, Jerry Robertson, and we'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins. Here's more important information about the Engage section of the amazing software for New Frontier Data called Equio. These are just examples of some of the things that Engage can do for you. You will be able to see and understand consumption preferences at the county, state, and even the zip code level. You'll want to follow product trends filtered by age and gender so you know exactly what to offer and how to market it. How about learning the market density of the location you might be considering to expanding your business? Use the Visit Index score to determine the trends that impact your outreach and messaging. Engage with your customer base to expand and repeat your value. You can learn more about product trends filtered by age and gender. This valuable information that helps you to know exactly what to offer and how to market it. Things are changing rapidly and you need the latest information from an independent source to keep yourself informed of the changing markets. For more information on the Equio software package, go to newfrontierdata.com, click on the Equio software, and don't forget to ask about the special offer. This is Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and joining us today is Marine Corps Major Scott Husing, and he's here to talk about several things. First, welcome to the program, Scott, and thank you for your service.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here, and we were actually, James Lowe and I were talking about you yesterday, singing your praises, veteran advocate, and it was great. I don't know if your ears were burning or not, but it's always good to be with you.
You were going to send me some the information on where I mail some players for you, so I didn't see that, so maybe it just slipped your mind, but if you could send me a mailing address, I'd be happy to send you some songs and stories for soldiers, additional MP3 players. So tell us about your foundation.
SaveTheBrave.org was started in 2015 with one of my fellow Marines. He's a amazing entrepreneur. He also was a machine gunner in my company when we fought together in Ramadi, Iraq. His name's Nick Velez. And we just experienced the loss of one of our squad leaders, Simon Lipke. He killed himself up in Minnesota. And we decided that we just didn't want to sit down and watch this happen to any more of our brothers, because those numbers, the statistics, 22 a day or whatever it is, that the
right.
VA reports, the DOD, they're friends. They're fellow Marines and warriors I fought with. They're not statistics. So we threw some money in the bank and we started SaveTheBrave.org. And it's a 100% veteran nonprofit that connects combat veterans who are struggling with post-traumatic stress through outreach programs. And over the last 6 years since then, we had one fishing trip that we started because we thought that would be cool. This year, we've got 36 trips servicing hundreds of veterans. But over the last 6 years, we've helped thousands of veterans, active duty, Gold Star families, first responders. And it's been an immense honor to be a part of this organization. And when I say we're 100% nonprofit, I want to clarify, none of us on the board take a single dime. We don't take a salary. We do this all because we love helping others. And at the beginning and the end of every day, I think that if you're not helping other people, you're really not helping yourself. And that's probably been biggest part of my transition, is just staying connected and staying very active. And as you know, I do that in a lot of different ways, not just through my writing and sharing stories, but the recent ride we did again this year, as I rode my Harley Davidson across the country for 3,161 miles. And, we're going to continue to do this, and we continue to get a lot of support from donors. We're privately funded, and we need the support of everybody out there to keep doing what we do best, and that's connecting veterans in a safe space.
I think it's, I agree with you. When I started my foundation for soldiers 7 years ago, about the same time you did, there are three officers of the foundation, and they all said that, number one, they would not take any salary or benefits, and they would pay their own expenses, so that 100% of every dollar we raise goes to purchase and distribute our MP3 players, maintain the website for veterans. So I believe in what you're doing, and because we've adopted it. So your ride was 3,100 miles. How long did it take you to ride?
So the ride for the Braves, as we call it, was again, it was another one of those things born out of tragedy. After my good friend Dave White, we went to high school together. He was a Navy vet. He killed himself in Montana last year. His mom asked me to come to South Carolina and give the eulogy, and I decided to kind of bucket list it and hop on my Harley and ride out there. And Nick Velez got a hold of it, started promoting it, and people found out I was riding my Harley across the country and back 5,150 miles last year. And it just kind of blew up, and everybody rallied around us. And this year, the guys talked me into doing it again, and I said yes. And we rode kind of a Pony Express from San Diego all the way to Miami, and we hit cities along the way. And what that did was it served as this unifying event last year and this year, and we'll probably do it again next year, more than likely. But it brought out so many amazing riders from American Legion riders, veterans, civilians, all to be connected and led and brought together. And what that did was really expose the best of the human condition to me, seeing and meeting so many thousands of people. And we stopped at local small businesses. They hosted events for us at, you know, Marty B's place in Bartonville, Texas, all these places along the way, and people just gathered and donated. We raised a ton of money this year as well to go back to veteran programs for SaveTheBrave.org. And the ride itself was, again, one of those things that, you know, again, born out of tragedy, but it was really an amazing experience for me, because I'll share one story. This year I was riding from Mississippi down to Alabama. I just like was crossing the state line. We pulled into this gas station on Highway 45, and this kid, this big country kid in this white pickup, pulls in and he says, "Hey man, how do I get one of those t-shirts?" And we're wearing the Ride for the Brave official t-shirts, and he gets out of his truck, gets a t-shirt, and then he tells me about his cousin, who was a Marine who served in Iraq, and shared some stories. And more profoundly, as he gets back into his truck and closes the door, he sticks his head out his window. He says, "Hey man, what y'all are doing is important. Keep it up." And he just drives away. And that right there was so emblematic of the type of people that I met along the way. This, you know, the true American fabric of great Americans who really are out there. They're not hidden anymore, because when you get out on your bike and you ride across the country, you get out and you volunteer, you really see the true essence of what we are as Americans, and not what's fed to us from mainstream media through the massive 60-inch filter on most people's wall. And that's a really cool part of what we do to connect people. And that the ride was just amazing. I tell you, I'm going to do it again next year. We've already got a ton of support lined up.
Good. Well, we'll keep in touch, and we want to follow that. The last thing I want to talk about is something that's important to me, how the VA has put restrictions on medications for veterans to deal with traumatic brain injury and PTSD, and also sleep deprivation. And two of those are, one is CBD and one is cannabis. The Department of Veterans Affairs has and the Defense Department have put out several releases over the last year saying to veterans, if you take CBD and it has THC and there's any level of THC in your blood for a blood test, you could lose your pension and you could lose your hospital benefits, healthcare benefits. And so veterans have chosen not to take the risk, but what happens is the VA gives them narcotics and they become addicted. I have a doctor friend who has a foundation that treats special operations personnel and who could discharge from the veterans facilities in Dallas, Texas. And he tells me that he gets people that are referred to him. They come in and he does a drug test and they're so full of opioids that the protocols that he wants to use can't help them until they've detoxified and got the opioids out of their system. We have a story on our website about a veteran, a Navy SEAL, who was injured 9 times and effectively was discharged on a medical discharge because he couldn't function because he was basically an opioid addict, and they sent him on his way. And his family intervened and got him involved with CBD and cannabis to try and wean him off of the opioids. So it's a problem that we have stuff out there, CBD and cannabis, that's all natural, that can help the suicide issue, which you're talking about. And yet the government refuses to do anything about it, no matter how much the science shows that these all natural products can help. In fact, Scott, I can make this statement, and I know it's true. There's never been a person who has died of an overdose of either cannabis or CBD. None. Never. And so I'm on a mission to try and get the VA to make more medications available to treat veterans who are opioid addicted. And I don't know whether you see those people in your travels across the country, but it's really a serious problem. We continue to put people at risk of committing suicide because the doctors are telling us now that the gate to suicide is sleep deprivation. If you don't get enough sleep, your body can't function. You can't make proper decisions. And so we think with CBD and cannabis, you can get that REM level sleep for veterans and get them healed so they won't reach for a gun in the middle of the night when the terrorists come. They'll reach for our MP3 player and a bottle of CBD or whatever. So your gentleman that you talked to us about who had killed themselves, were they feeling they were PTSD sufferers?
Well, again, I'm not qualified to talk. I'm not a medical professional. I never profess to have all of that information. But whenever there's large amounts of alcohol involved, I know having been down that road as a depressant that, you know, that creates a lot of anxiety and depression they're dealing with. And I think, you know, again, I don't know what the toxicology was on those two. One was Dave drank himself to death. Simon shot himself. And nobody really saw the signs coming because they were both engaged at the time. They were texting. They were, you know, it just really was no warning signs that people were acutely aware of. And that's one of the things that we have to really be cognizant of as friends and family is when guys tend to even remotely become isolated or make statements or abuse alcohol or substances of any kind, we got to be tuned into that and really reach out or throw them a lifeline and try and pull them to safety. Sadly, there's some people that refuse to grab hold. And, you know, we try and jump in the water and sometimes save them, but tragically some are just destined to sink. And right. You know, I think whatever the modality is that works for you, whether it's cannabis, opioids, pharmacology, whatever it is, whatever works best for you, I think is important. I think it's the same can be said for what we do in the nonprofit space. You know, we do a lot of offshore fishing, but maybe fishing isn't your thing. Maybe riding your Harley is, maybe riding your bike, maybe it's hiking. And I like to think that in the nonprofit space, you know, we've done a really good job over the last 10 years of creating safety nets, so to speak, so all of our veterans can pick and choose. And there's a lot that are very well established, that are very credible, like SaveTheBrave.org and others that have the capacity to really help these guys. And then once we have them on board, if they need further treatment, we have a great network of resources through clinical professionals that we can vector those veterans to. And I think that we're in a good position now with the next tidal wave of veterans who are getting off active duty. You know, the guys like my peers, the senior enlisted, the senior officers, that they've really compartmentalized all that trauma for the last decade, and they're going to have to unpack that eventually. And hopefully they do it in a productive, constructive way through things like we do, like giving back and staying engaged, not drinking themselves stupid or abusing opioids or narcotics in any way, form or fashion. I think that that's really the message we're trying to get out there, to empower our veteran tribe and let them know that there is a huge network and a group of people that love you and are willing to help you along the way through that transition if you're struggling.
Well, thank you for your time today, Scott. And how can people learn more about your organization?
They can go to SaveTheBrave.org, and you can find out more about our trips. You can sign up for a trip. You can buy merchandise and show your support, or you can click and make a donation. You can make a one-time donation or a monthly recurring donation. You know, that's the call to action to listeners. $5-$10 a month, less than the cost of a tank of gas, unless you live in my state of California, of course. You can follow the Ride for the Brave at SaveTheBrave.org on Instagram. We catalog this year's ride on video, and there's a ton of great shots from our media team. If you want to get involved, go to SaveTheBrave.org. Send us a message. We respond to everybody's messages and emails out there, and it's just something we're really happy to do.
Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Dan. Take care, brother.
My pleasure. If you missed any of this terrific interview with Scott, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, go to the archive section for America's Cannabis Conversation, and you can download this interview and listen to it in its entirety. Thank you, and we'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins. Here's more important information about the Engage section of the amazing software for New Frontier Data called Equio. These are just examples of some of the things that Engage can do for you. You will be able to see and understand consumption preferences at the county, state, and even the zip code level. You'll want to follow product trends filtered by age and gender so you know exactly what to offer and how to market it. How about learning the market density of the location you might be considering to expanding your business? Use the Visit Index score to determine the trends that impact your outreach and messaging. Engage with your customer base to expand and repeat your value. You can learn more about product trends filtered by age and gender. This valuable information, it helps you to know exactly what to offer and how to market it. Things are changing rapidly, and you need the latest information from an independent source to keep yourself informed of the changing markets. For more information on the Equio software package, go to newfrontierdata.com, click on the Equio software, and don't forget to ask about the special offer. This is Dan Perkins.
Welcome to the conversation, and join us for a second time is Dr. Deborah Verholden, PhD from Michigan State University. She is the C.S. Mott Endowed Professor of Public Health and has probably written more papers than I have, which is tough to do, but she obviously has a lot to say. Dr. Holden, thank you for coming to the conversation today.
Thank you for having me back, Dan. I'm always up for a good conversation.
Thank you. Well, tell us about your new initiative.
Yeah, so I'm in Genesee County, Michigan, and what we're seeing, and a lot of states will be going through this as they start to reform and change their marijuana laws, is we have provisioning centers that are coming into our community. And so what we've tried to do is say everybody has a dog in the fight with how we sort of move forward in this new era, where in many states, marijuana has either been decriminalized, medicalized, or legalized. So I don't fault the businesses that are coming in. There's a whole new marketplace that's been opened up, and I believe in an open marketplace. The problem is that marketplace is not fairly and equitably accessible to everybody. You need at least $1 million and some political friends to open up a provisioning center in the state of Michigan. You've got to get through planning commissions and zoning boards and all of that, and that's a very political process. Then you've got to have a strong business model. Then you've got to have the startup funds to be able to get your building ready, to get your products ready, and all of that before the doors can open. So if you can imagine, how many of us just have $1 million lying around in the bank?
Not many.
Definitely people who have, yeah, not many. And definitely people who have been the victim or the on the negative consequences of many of the laws that are in place. You know, you get a felony conviction. I call it the scarlet letter. It becomes nearly impossible to get employment. If you have a felony conviction, when you go into jail, if you were on Medicaid before that, you lose your Medicaid benefits. And when you come out, you are no longer allowed to live in public housing, and certain federal entitlements are no longer available to you. So we've got a lot of people, and I don't know if people have really thought about all of the tentacles that reach out from some of these drug laws and the negative impact that it's had on individuals' lives, on the functioning of families, and on the overall functioning of communities. And so we thought, okay, great. So we are putting the press on our legislators. We want our legislators to enact laws and policies that will help us to redress some of these historical wrongs or some of the historical impacts that these laws have had on people. And we're also asking the people who are in power, the people who do have the privilege of having $1 million in the bank, of being able to navigate the political landscape and the administrative process of opening up these marijuana centers. We're asking them to join the fight. So what we've done in Flint, which I'm super proud of, is we brokered an agreement with a new center that's coming in. And we said, would you be willing to be a partner with us in this fight? And they said, sure, what would that look like? So we said, we're interested in two main things, equity, leveling the playing field, and restorative justice. So what they've agreed to do is to give 1% of their top line sales to a fund that will go to a local community foundation that will be run by citizens and members in our community who have been affected by marijuana laws, people with the public health expertise, people from the business sector. This will provide an opportunity for people who have previously been negatively impacted by old marijuana laws to now become stakeholders in potential opportunities from these new laws. It's transformative, like totally transformative, and it's top line. Their business plan, and I can't name the company, for, you know, it will be for them if, you know, we do this for a year and it works well. I really want to give them all of the credit because this is just good stewardship, in my opinion. They don't owe us anything. This is a business. But what we realize in public health is getting all the sectors involved, not just public health. The money that we have for public health pales in comparison to the money that you have in business. You know, literally the advertising budget for big tobacco is more than three times the entire budget of the National Institutes of Health, just their annual advertising budget. So, you know, public health is a little guy in the fight, but we're an important voice. So we want to bring in the business sector. We want to bring in community. We want to bring in citizens with lived experience who've been impacted and collectively build models. We've got legislators at the table, collectively build a model that begins to restore people to whole and level the playing field so that everybody has skin in the game.
Is it open? Are you operating now?
We are navigating right now the process of getting the proper zoning for the site. So if all goes well, and it has been like pushing a boulder uphill. But again, we've got some critical players. We've got people in the business sector. We've got the owner of the building who's on board. We've got many of our elected officials who are on board. Strong support from other business owners and members of the community where the center is going to go. And most importantly, we've got people in the community who've been affected historically by some of these drug laws who have said, we want this. So if all goes well, the door should open within the next 3 to 4 months, and I would love to come back and give you an update. One last thing I got to share.
Yes.
One last thing. The other piece of this agreement that we have reached is that they will employ 75% of the staff at the center will come from the city of Flint. So they will say, they are saying, not only are we going to come here, their business model is strong. Their anticipated daily top line sales is $30,000 a day. Their anticipated revenue is $30,000 a day. They're going to employ 75% of the staff from the city of Flint, and they've made an agreement that the demographic profile of the staff will closely mirror the demographic profile of the city. So if the city is 55% African-American, 55% of their employees will be African-American. They are providing a living wage, $18 an hour, as a starting salary for staff. They get full benefits, which includes health insurance, paid days off, and 401k benefits, retirement benefits for the staff. And they've added the real big bonus, which is an educational contribution for any staff who are pursuing college degrees, whether they be undergraduate or graduate degrees. This has the potential to be transformative. And what I really love about it is it's big business saying we're willing to share a bit of the profits to help restore people to whole and join the restorative justice movement. So I'm super excited to see how this initiative goes. I can imagine we're going to have some bumps in the road and all of that, but all of us who are at the table are committed to moving forward, because if this works, what a beautiful model this could be, where, you know, this new marketplace and these new business owners become a critical piece in the process of helping to level the playing field.
Is this, do you believe that this is scalable to go to other cities, not only in Flint, but around the country?
I think it's absolutely scalable. And the business side of it is, because the money that's going back to community is going to a local nonprofit community foundation, that money provides them also some tax credit. So not only can they exercise goodwill, but they are also then, because, you know, when you pay taxes, you know, it goes into some state general fund, and the how that money is then dispersed and used to take care of the state's needs totally resides in the hands of people who some of us may have elected and some of us may have not. This actually puts a little bit of the say on how resources that our tax dollars generate back into the hands of the people. And so I think it's a great model, and I think it's absolutely scalable. And it's nothing that we would force, but it's like goodwill being a good steward of opportunity and privilege.
Well, thank you, Dr. Holden. And we do want to hear from you, but I suspect we'll have you back on before the 90 days. You're a terrific guest. We've been speaking to Deborah Furr Holden, PhD, who is the C.S. Moffitt Endowed Professor of Public Health at Michigan State University. Thank you, Deborah, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
You're welcome. If you missed any of this terrific interview, and it's important, you should hear it, go to W420RadioNetwork.com. And go to the archive section and look for Dr. Furr Holden, PhD's interview. There's another one on there, too, so listen to both of them. You'll be better off.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins for America's Cannabis Conversation, and I want to tell you about a new sponsor, New Frontier Data, and their Equio amazing software to help you discover, engage, and compete in the cannabis marketplace. For the first time, you have the ability to discover on your computer desktop valuable information on state, city, and even zip codes to assess your opportunities for cannabis investment in that market. Through the Engage portion, you will be able to figure out what products in a marketplace consumers would be interested in buying. And finally, with Compete, you'll be able to look at prospect profiles and find new and innovative opportunities to test new products to attract new customers. Significant change is coming in the cannabis industry, And you need to get ready now and be prepared for this fantastic opportunity ahead of you. For more information on the EQO software for your business, go to newfrontierdata.com and look for the EQO section and expand your horizons. I'm Dan Perkins.
W420RadioNetwork.com